For another walk down memory lane, I'd love to know where we've been, because it's taken us a long time to get to where we are, and it gives an appreciation, in my mind, for where we have come as a people. Let me give to you, in whatever order they want, Laura Herman and Vinnie Taglerino.
Those were the days.
Who was the meathead that played that?
George.
George.
That's funny.
After hearing Dr. Menna's account of this wonderful, exciting, and rewarding life, I hope we won't bore you, but I've been asked to tell you what it was like for me before we founded our federation. I am a member of a large Italian family. I had 7 brothers and 1 sister, and we lived in a neighborhood 99% Italian. Many of my cousins lived there, so I was never at a loss for people to play with. I didn't even realize I couldn't see when I was a kid, because whenever we played baseball, somebody would just run up, grab my hand and put a bat in it, and if the bat came anywhere near us, they'd help me swing it. And if I was lucky enough to hit the ball, I would run to first base. That's about as far as my hits went. So, so I never thought I was any different from any kid, because I was treated just like the rest of them. Until one day, an old friend of my mom's, an elderly friend of my mother, whom we called Zia Croce in Italian, which means Aunt Cross. That was her name. I was standing with my mother, and she came up to us, and she leaned over me, made the sign of the cross on my forehead, and kissed me, and said, "Oh, Mrs. Pagano, is this your blind child?" And my mother said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, you know, we all have a cross to bear." And I can still feel the explosion in my head. I said, "Me being somebody's cross to bear? What do you mean? No way." So I think that was the beginning of my realizing that I had to really do things more or less on my own, because I don't think anybody even, I know my parents always said that I was nearsighted. Well, I wasn't, I was blind, but you know, it made them feel better to say I was nearsighted, but you know.
Very nearsighted.
Very nearsighted. But that was the beginning of my realization that I think I would have to put a little extra effort into trying to live the kind of life I wanted to live. Because it would have been so easy for me to be taken care of by my mom, my dad, my brothers, my family. I mean, it would have been so easy, but I knew that that was not what I wanted to be. And in those days, no child was, especially a girl, no child was ever sent away from home to go to school. So when my parents were convinced that in order to get a decent education, I would have to go to Batavia, it was very hard for them to say go. But the old Italian ladies in the neighborhood, of course, thought that my mom was very cruel to send me away to school. But anyhow, I went to school, and really, Batavia, those of you who went to Batavia know we had a very a high educational standard there. We really got excellent training insofar as our academics were concerned. Well, this was during the 20s when most of us were very poor. My parents did not have a car, so in order to come get me for vacations and bring me back, we had to have friends or relatives drive me. after I had attended school, I was about maybe 12, it dawned on me, other people are going home by bus or train, why can't I? So when I went home, I said to my father, you don't have to ask Uncle Jim to drive me anymore, I'm going to come home by train. Of course, my father said no, he couldn't conceive of it, you know, something might happen and so forth. Well, we argued for a while, finally I said to him, Papa, it doesn't matter what you say, because I'm not telling you when vacations are, so the next time you hear from me, I'll be at the Niagara Falls train station. So, I thought my father said, okay, you know, he was very worried. And my first trip on the train coming home was unbelievable. I was nervous, but when I arrived in Niagara Falls, there was my father, my six or seven brothers, my sister, four or five cousins in for good measure, just in case. And I said, Princess Diana never got such a reception. It was just wonderful. And so that was the beginning of my realizing that in order to get to do what I felt I could do, I had to put that much extra effort on my own. And I think one of my faults was I never consulted with anybody because I figured they'd try to talk me out of it and I wasn't going to do that. One of my interesting experiences in Batavia was when our scout group, I was a senior then, our scout troop invited the sighted scouts from the city, from Batavia, to a swim party. So, of course, we didn't know these girls, and they didn't know us. So we were, I dove off the diving board, and all of a sudden, somebody grabbed my leg. And I says, oh, it's one of those sighted kids trying to be smart. So I sort of kicked back and tried to swim on, and again, somebody grabbed my leg. Well, by this time, I said, if I ever get this person, she will be sorry. So I reached out my arm. I don't know how it happened, but it ended up like under her chin so that I had her by the neck. And I swam to the side. It was like a breaststroke. You know, I had one arm around her and I just took, you know, her that way with her head over above water. I figured when I get her to the side, I'll decide what to do with her. Well, as I got to the side, all of a sudden people rushed to the side of the pool. Somebody threw a pole out and said, Laura, grab that pole. Like, what am I going to do? Well, I grabbed the pole. And they pulled us in. And before I knew what was happening, they were all thanking me for saving this girl's life. And I was too chicken to admit that I wasn't really saving her life.
You were trying to kill her.
Right. So I never told her. Her name was Patty Birmingham. I never told anybody the truth because, I mean, how could you? People thought you were so great, you know? So, anyhow, I graduated from Batavia in 1944, so it was during the Second World War. And although I had studied to do office work, and also I had been given the opportunity to received a Skidmore scholarship for Skidmore College. Well, that wasn't in my plan. And of course, I didn't discuss it with my mother or father because I figured I know what I want to do and I'm doing it. So I said, no, I don't want to go to college because there's this big war going on and I am going to work in the defense plant to help bring this war to an end. So I, the day after graduation, I went I knew I did not want a sighted adult person to accompany me, because all my life, whenever I was with a sighted person, people would never talk to me. They would always say, oh, is she home from school? How is she enjoying it? And I would say nothing. So I got this 12-year-old girl, and I said to her, Ida, I'd like you to walk me to the carborundum. I'm going to apply for a job. But don't you dare answer one question, even if they're asking you. This is my interview. I don't want anybody to talk for me. So I got there, and I was interviewed, and the little girl was so scared. At the end of the interview, I did a couple other things, and Mr. Hapgood said to me, well, we'll let you know Monday whether you have the job. I said, okay. He says, I'll call you Thursday, and Thursday came. I did not receive a call. I waited until about 2:00 in the afternoon, and I called him, and I says, hello, Mr. Hapgood. This is Laura Pagano. You said you'd let me know whether I had the job. And he says, well, and I heard him shuffling papers, and he says, well, you have to have a physical examination before I can tell you. And I said, well, I don't know what you're saying, because after you spoke to me, somebody put me in the line, and I walked along with the line, and they did give me a physical examination. So he says, oh, well, then come on in Monday. I started work on Monday, my big old defense job. I'll have to tell you what it was, because it was not too challenging. I was presented with a huge box of wheels with holes in the middle, and 10 rubber fingers, little glove fingers that you put over your fingers, about an eight inch long iron rod, and my job was to rub the wheels together. That's what we call sanding wheels. I sanded one side, sanded the other side, and then...
Sorry.
And then I had to put the bushings through the hole and grind, like you're rolling a pie crust or something, and grind until the hole became the right size for the bushing. Well, not very challenging, but I had a lot of time for daydreaming anyhow.
Your
bushing. So I did this job for about, maybe 8 or maybe a year. And then I said, well, I'm sure that some of my wheels must have gotten to the boys overseas. I know I must have done my share. So I went to my supervisor and asked for a transfer to the main office. You know, I wasn't going to sand wheels anymore. So anyhow, I received the transfer, and it was a very... very interesting job. In those days, we used carbon copies, so I had 6 different colored paper, and each different color had a carbon in between, and each color sheet was then given to whatever department it referred to. Well, how I did that for about until the end of the war, when they decided to, when the boys came home and the girls came home, and they had to cut down, so I was let go. Then I took the civil service exam and passed it. I went to work at social services as a stenographer and interpreter, where I worked for, that's where I retired from. I worked there 35 years. And I had the most beautiful life. I mean, I used to go to USO dances, put on our dirndl skirts, our saddle shoes and bobby socks. We'd meet evenings and knit scarves and gloves. Not gloves, I never got to the glove department. I just did scarves for the boys overseas. And in 1954, I met my husband. We became engaged and bought a home and planned our marriage for November of 1955. I was just living this wonderful life, and I I was just so happy. I said, this is what everybody should be living. I never realized that there were other blind people who weren't doing this until I received an invitation in July of 1956, a letter signed by Tony Parisi, President, Dominic DeJohn, Vice President, Ellie Raines, Secretary, Ray Dinsmore, Treasurer, asking us to attend a meeting in Syracuse in the month of September. So I went to this meeting. I really don't know why, but I figured, oh, I'll go. And anything, maybe life was boring. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't as good as I thought it was. But anyhow, I did go to the meeting. And it was then, believe it or not, that I realized when I heard what these people were gathered there for. Number one, the first thing that we discussed was the fact that college education was not available for any for a blind student who could only afford to go to a state university. So we, of course, passed that. I'll just tell you what the grievances were, and then you'll know. Within this 50 years, we have overcome all those obstacles. Also, blind person could not rent an apartment based on the fact that he was blind. And there were blind people who were employed and would have liked to have gotten away from their family, but couldn't because nobody would rent them a home. So they had to stay home and, you know, 3 minutes. Oh. I know. I wish you hadn't. Okay. Carry on my conversation here. So anyhow, and it was then that I realized that the organization needed people like me. Not the people, you know, it wasn't only attractive to the people who were deprived of the normal human rights, that, you know, to be discriminated against, people who couldn't rent a house, people who couldn't go to school. It was only attracted to people who were needed. But to me, I couldn't believe that people lived that way, and I knew that if I could do anything to help change conditions for the blind, and I've been on this road to first-class citizenship since 1956, we have accomplished so much, and every now and then I would worry, what's going to happen to the Federation, you know, when the old people die or leave or whatever? And now that I see this wonderful group of young, enthusiastic, energetic people, most of you guys who have benefited by what we have done, I know that our Federation's going to be in very, very good hands, and it is the most wonderful thing that's happened to me to be a part of this movement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank President Carroll for having me here and come up and talk to you about the days before our Federation, a little bit after. You know, I'd like to mention one thing about Laura. I don't know if everybody knows her this or not, but Laura is one of our past presidents of the National Federation of the Blind of New York State. Yeah, she is. She's a dynamic person. And she's an inspiration, I'll tell you, to many, many people. She's a very close friend of mine. Well, you know, 50 years is really a milestone. I'm proud to be a member of the National Federation of the Blind for 50 years and a chartered member of the Buffalo chapter. I've learned a lot with this organization, and I've learned about many, many problems blind people have had because they're blind. And I'll tell you, this organization has helped thousands and thousands of people over the years. Myself, for those who don't know what I've been involved with, how I am, I had a dream. Now, you heard that expression? Yeah, okay. I wanted to be a musician. I also wanted to be, later on when I got in high school, I wanted to own a music store. Well, you know, those dreams came true the hard way. Let me tell you. I come from a family of five. I had two brothers, two sisters. My father was the only one working. Those days, that's all he did. I only had one parent working. My father worked in the maintenance department at a water pumping station for the city of Buffalo. He never made much money, but he always made sure we had food on the table and we always survived and had and were satisfied with what we had. When I was 4 years old, I was starting to play the piano. Well, my oldest sister used to take lessons, and I learned a lot from her. And before you know, by the time I'm seven, my parents decided maybe you better give me lessons. See, I was playing many songs by then. So when I was about seven, we had a cousin, my mother's first cousin, would naturally be my second, started giving me lessons. He was only right around the corner, about two blocks away. So I took lessons. Now, I was in a public school at this time. I have RP, retinitis pigmentosa. And what happened there, when I got into fifth grade, I was sitting either in the middle or the back of the class, I didn't remember, but I couldn't read the blackboard very well. It started, my sight started going down. Teacher put me up in the front of the class, brought my name up to the principal, and he had to do something about my eyes. So my parents decided, they heard about the New York State School for the Blind in Batavia, and they transferred me over there. Now what happened when I transferred, even though I had sight, the best thing they did, and I thank that school to this day for what they did, even though I had a lot of sight, they made me learn to read and write Braille. Yeah. I used to try to read those dots with my eyes, and they took me right off of it. No, read it with your hands, your fingers. That's what they did. And I'll tell you, God bless that school there. That everything I do is Braille. I'm so happy about that they did that. They made me do it. And that school had a lot of things, a lot of independence. They didn't treat you like a blind person. They didn't treat you that because you're blind, you can't do this, can't do that. Like an idea, one of the requirements being there, you had to take typewriter to learn how to type so you could communicate with sighted people. They had a swimming pool there. Unless you had a doctor's excuse, you had to go swimming and learn how to swim. These are great things that we learned about. They had a manual training arts class, which is a woodwork class. You learn how to use a lathe machine. You learn how to use the drills, power saws, table saws, drill press. The teacher in that woodwork department was blind himself. They had a piano tuning department, a full course piano tuning department. He was blind himself. And later on, I got into that department. But one of the things that woodwork, I think everybody had to get at least 1 year of woodwork to learn a little bit about tools and how to use it and the safety part of it. They didn't hold back on anything. Like today, I had one when I was president of the Buffalo chapter. We had a young fellow who went to Buff State and wanted to get in there, learn about wood. Well, they discriminated against him because they said he was blind and were worried he was going to get cut and hurt himself. And everything went out of machines. Well, you know, the National Federation of the Blind stepped in. Come on, they had a lawsuit against him. And what happened? He won the case, and they had to teach him how to use all those machines. We're proud of that one. So as time went on in the school, I like to say another thing. In our dormitory at Batavia, they had a skating rink. And we could use it anytime we wanted. Now, the way the skating rink worked, they had a hump. Now, it's a rectangular shape to begin with. They had a hump in the center of the rink, and if you hit that hump while you're skating, that means you're going to cross the line. So we knew that. On the right edges as you're skating, no matter what side you're on, there's a little incline. The incline indicates you're going to hit the wall. And I'll tell you, you didn't want to hit those walls. They were stucco walls. And I'll tell you, we did several times. But at the end of the ring, to warn you that you're coming to the end, they had another bigger incline, because they got to allow you time to get up there if you're skating fast. And they had about 2 foot of flat land, and the other end on that wall there was a big mat a mat like you would have at the wrestlers had. And that was, so you didn't bang into the wall, you bang into the mat. That, the two of these students at school, Ken Williams and right here from Syracuse, and John Pauling, trumpet and drums, we started playing the Batavia High School dances for 2 years. And that was quite an accomplishment. We had a lot of fun doing this. Now, what happened when I was ready to graduate, I couldn't afford, as I said, to go to college. I got a scholarship out of Hartwick College to go to the music camp. So I went to the music camp, and after that, what happened is I couldn't go to college. They wanted me to go to college, and I did. It was very disappointing, not having any money. So they ended the camp. They gave me a scholarship to go one semester, hoping me I could come up with money someplace somehow. I couldn't. So I did go to that semester, but that was the end of that. Now, there's a will, there's a way. When I got out of school in 1955, I got my first music job in Buffalo 2 nights a week. My father would bring me to the job. Then what happened at 2:30 in the morning, I had to find my way to get home. I found a way. What I did, I took a cab the first weekend. The next week, we'll make this quick. The next week, what happened, I had to take I found the bus. I knew if I would get home about 4 in the morning. So that's what we did. There's always a way. So I got home, I found my way, and everything. Let me see here. We'll cut a lot of this out here. So, okay, let me finish. Let me say this. I can't finish the rest of this, but I did tune for many, many promoters in Buffalo after I started my shop. I had to borrow money. There was no way else I can get it. So I had a lot of three big promoters I played for, not played, I tuned for many of the stars, like Engelberg, Tom Jones, Paul Anka, Sammy Davis Jr. I did all of these guys, did all their tunes, Rich Stadium and Elton John. I did mainly that. The business was going pretty good, but I had to borrow money. And one quick story before I finish. I released a store in the next block from my home. This is the hard way I did it. After I had my shop built, I wanted to move into the store because I was outgrowing it. I get in there, I went to the commission, and you know, the commission okayed me all the way through and everything that I needed. They moved all my stuff in. One of the warehouses moved all the equipment in that the commission okayed. Well, my case went to Albany, and it was rejected. Needless to know, I was very, very depressed. All of the equipment, some of it had to go back, but some of it I had to borrow money again to get that equipment in and get the store going. Well, it lasted 1 year, and I had to go back into my shop until I got the business built up a lot more. But you see, this is the hard way. My parents didn't have money, but I was determined to do what I wanted to do and get a music store going and playing. I built the business up. And I'm going to say the Federation started in 56, and I started on my own in 1960, and many, many things that I learned. Stay with the National Federation of the Blind. You can't go wrong with that. You learn a lot of things. You learn how to cope with them. You learn how to help people understand about it. I'm proud to be a member of the National Federation of the Blind, and all of you respect this organization. We've seen how it's grown. Look at the National Center, what they did down there. You're proud to talk about it. I want to say thank you, Carl. And thank you, everyone, for letting me talk about my experience.
Hey, thank you.
My question, I guess I'll start with Laura, is we've heard over the years that there has been quite a bit of abuse of children at Batavia. Was that happening when you were a child, and do you have any sense of what's happening today?
Well, when we attended school, to the best of my knowledge, was that there was no abuse. I think we received very good care. And also, the children in those days were, at the time that I was going there, were blind, but no other handicaps. Now the children that are there now are people who are children who are very, very developmentally challenged. I don't think they would even know that they were being abused. And with most of these children's families, really actually just take them to the school and forget them. And from what I have heard, nothing has been done. I think the superintendent was fired, but I've talked to the president of the alumni, and the opinion seems to be that everything's been taken care of, but it's the same thing as elderly persons when they go to a nursing home and they have no family. Yes, when you have no family to check on you, I think the abuses are more blatant than they are if they know you have somebody who cares for you. And it's one of these unfortunate things. That's about where we are.